This was unacceptable. I adopted a new procedure. Instead of reading the booklets in sequence, I read and scored all the students' answers to the first question, then went on to the next one. I made sure to write all the scores on the inside back page of the booklet so that I would not be biased, even unconsciously, when I read the second essay. Soon after switching to the new method, I made a disconcerting observation. My confidence in my grading now was much lower than it had been. The reason was that I frequently experienced a discomfort that was new to me. When I was disappointed with a student's second essay and went to the back page of the booklet to enter a poor grade, I occasionally discovered that I had given a top grade to the same student's first essay. I also noticed that I was tempted to reduce the discrepancy by changing the grade that I had not yet written down, and found it hard to follow the simple rule of never yielding to that temptation. My grades for the essays of a single student often varied over a considerable range. The lack of coherence left me uncertain and frustrated. I was now less happy with and less confident in my grades than I had been earlier, but I recognized that this was a good sign, an indication that the new procedure was superior. The consistency I had enjoyed earlier was spurious. It produced a feeling of cognitive ease, and my system, too, was happy to lazily accept the final grade. By allowing myself to be strongly influenced by the first question in evaluating subsequent ones, I spared myself the dissonance of finding the same student doing very well on some questions and badly on others. The uncomfortable inconsistency that was revealed when I switched to the new procedure was real. It reflected both the inadequacy of any single question as a measure of what the student knew and the unreliability of my own grading. The procedure I adopted to tame the halo effect conforms to a general principle: decorrelate error. To understand how this principle works, imagine that a large number of observers are shown glass jars containing pennies and are challenged to estimate the number of pennies in each jar. As James Surowiecki explained in his best-selling The Wisdom of Crowds, this is the kind of task in which individuals do very poorly, but pools of individual judgments do remarkably well. Some individuals greatly overestimate the true number, others underestimate it, but when many judgments are averaged, the average tends to be quite accurate. The mechanism is straightforward. All individuals look at the same jar, and all their judgments have a common basis. On the other hand, the errors that individuals make are independent of the errors made by others, and, in the absence of a systematic bias, they tend to average to zero. However, the magic of error reduction works well only when the observations are independent and their errors uncorrelated. If the observers share a bias, the aggregation of judgments will not reduce it. Allowing the observers to influence each other effectively reduces the size of the sample, and with it, the precision of the group estimate. To derive the most useful information from multiple sources of evidence, you should always try to make these sources independent of each other. This rule is part of good police procedure. When there are multiple witnesses to an event, they are not allowed to discuss it before giving their testimony. The goal is not only to prevent collusion by hostile witnesses, it is also to prevent unbiased witnesses from influencing each other. Witnesses who exchange their experiences will tend to make similar errors in their testimony, reducing the total value of the information they provide. Eliminating redundancy from your sources of information is always a good idea. The principle of independent judgments and decorrelated errors has immediate applications for the conduct of meetings, an activity in which executives and organizations spend a great deal of their working days. A simple rule can help. Before an issue is discussed, all members of the committee should be asked to write a very brief summary of their position. This procedure makes good use of the value of the diversity of knowledge and opinion in the group. The standard practice of open discussion gives too much weight to the opinions of those who speak early and assertively, causing others to line up behind them. What you see is all there is. One of my favorite memories of the early years of working with Amos is a comedy routine he enjoyed performing. In a perfect impersonation of one of the professors with whom he had studied psychology as an undergraduate, Amos would growl in Hebrew, marked by a thick German accent, "You must never forget the primate of the is." What exactly his teacher had meant by that phrase never became clear to me, or to Amos, I believe, but Amos's jokes always made a point. He was reminded of the old phrase, and eventually I was too, whenever we encountered the remarkable asymmetry between the ways our mind treats information that is currently available and information we do not have. An essential design feature of the associative machine is that it represents only activated ideas. Information that is not retrieved, even unconsciously, from memory might as well not exist. System 1 excels at constructing the best possible story that incorporates ideas currently activated, but it does not, cannot allow for information it does not have. The measure of success for System 1 is the coherence of the story it manages to create. The amount and quality of the data on which the story is based are largely irrelevant. When information is scarce, which is a common occurrence, System 1 operates as a machine for jumping to conclusions. Consider the following. Will Mindick be a good leader? She is intelligent and strong. An answer quickly came to your mind, and it was yes. You picked the best answer based on the very limited information available, but you jumped the gun. What if the next two adjectives were corrupt and cruel? Take note of what you did not do as you briefly thought of Mindick as a leader. You did not start by asking, what would I need to know before I formed an opinion about the quality of someone's leadership? System 1 got to work on its own from the first adjective. Intelligent is good. Intelligent and strong is very good. This is the best story that can be constructed from two adjectives, and System 1 delivered it with great cognitive ease. The story will be revised if new information comes in, such as Mindick is corrupt. But there is no waiting and no subjective discomfort, and there also remains a bias favoring the first impression. The combination of a coherence-seeking System 1 with a lazy System 2 implies that System 2 will endorse many intuitive beliefs which closely reflect the impressions generated by System 1. Of course, System 2 also is capable of a more systematic and careful approach to evidence and of following a list of boxes that must be checked before making a decision. Think of buying a home when you deliberately seek information that you don't have. However, System 1 is expected to influence even the more careful decisions. Its input never ceases. Jumping to conclusions on the basis of limited evidence is so important to an understanding of intuitive thinking that it comes up so often in this book that I will use a cumbersome abbreviation for it. WYSIATI, which stands for What You See Is All There Is. System 1 is radically insensitive to both the quality and the quantity of the information that gives rise to impressions and intuitions. Amos, with two of his graduate students at Stanford, reported a study that bears directly on "what you see is all there is" by observing the reaction of people who are given one-sided evidence and know it. The participants were exposed to legal scenarios such as the following. On September 3rd, plaintiff David Thornton, a 43-year-old Union Field representative, was present in Thrifty Drugstore No. 168, performing a routine union visit. Within 10 minutes of his arrival, a store manager confronted him and told him he could no longer speak with the union employees on the floor of the store. Instead, he would have to see them in a back room while they were on break. Such a request is allowed by the union contract with Thrifty Drug, but had never before been enforced. When Mr. Thornton objected, he was told that he had the choice of conforming to these requirements, leaving the store, or being arrested. At this point, Mr. Thornton indicated to the manager that he had always been allowed to speak to employees on the floor for as much as 10 minutes, as long as no business was disrupted, and that he would rather be arrested than change the procedure of his routine visit. The manager then called the police and had Mr. Thornton handcuffed in the store for trespassing. After he was booked and put into a holding cell for a brief time, all charges were dropped. Mr. Thornton is suing Thrifty Drug for false arrest. In addition to this background material, which all participants read, different groups were exposed to presentations by the lawyers for the two parties. Naturally, the lawyer for the union organizer described the arrest as an intimidation attempt, while the lawyer for the store argued that having the talk in the store was disruptive and that the manager was acting properly. Some participants, like a jury, heard both sides. The lawyers added no useful information that you could not infer from the background story. The participants were fully aware of the setup, and those who heard only one side could easily have generated the argument for the other side. Nevertheless, the presentation of one-sided evidence had a very pronounced effect on judgments. Furthermore, participants who saw one-sided evidence were more confident of their judgments than those who saw both sides. This is just what you would expect if the confidence that people experience is determined by the coherence of the story they manage to construct from available information. It is the consistency of the information that matters for a good story, not its completeness. Indeed, you will often find that knowing little makes it easier to fit everything you know into a coherent pattern. What you see as all there is essential to creating associative coherence and the cognitive ease that causes us to accept a statement as true. It explains why we can think fast and how we are able to make sense of partial information in a complex world. Much of the time, the coherent story we put together is close enough to reality to support reasonable action. However, I will also invoke what you see as all there is to help explain a long and diverse list of biases of judgment and choice, including the following, among many others. Overconfidence. As the "what you see is all there is" rule implies, neither the quantity nor the quality of the evidence counts for much in subjective confidence. The confidence that individuals have in their beliefs depends mostly on the quality of the story they can tell about what they see, even if they see little. We often fail to allow for the possibility that evidence that should be critical to our judgment is missing. What we see is all there is. Furthermore, our associative system tends to settle on a coherent pattern of activation and suppresses doubt and ambiguity. Framing effects. Different ways of presenting the same information often evoke different emotions. The statement that the odds of survival 1 month after surgery are 90% is more reassuring than the equivalent statement that Mortality within 1 month of surgery is 10%. Similarly, cold cuts described as 90% fat-free are more attractive than when they are described as 10% fat. The equivalence of the alternative formulations is transparent, but an individual normally sees only one formulation, and what she sees is all there is. Base rate neglect. Recall Steve, the meek and tidy soul who is often believed to be a librarian. The personality description is salient and vivid. And although you surely know that there are more male farmers than male librarians, that statistical fact almost certainly did not come to your mind when you first considered the question. What you saw was all there was. More generally, statistical information is often ignored in making forecasts about individual cases because it tends to be less vivid, salient, and interesting than specific information about the case at hand. Speaking of jumping to conclusions, she knows nothing about this person's management skills. All she is going by is the halo effect from a good presentation. Let's decorrelate errors by obtaining separate judgments on the issue before any discussion. We will get more information from independent assessments. They made that big decision on the basis of a good report from one consultant. What you see is all there is. They did not seem to realize how little information they had. They didn't want more information that might spoil their story. What you see is all there is. Chapter 8. How judgments happen. There is no limit to the number of questions you can answer, whether they are questions someone else asks or questions you ask yourself. Nor is there a limit to the number of attributes you can evaluate. You are capable of counting the number of capital letters on a page, comparing the height of the windows of your house to the one across the street, and assessing the political prospects of your senator on a scale from excellent to disastrous. The questions are addressed to System 2, which will direct attention and search memory to find the answers. System 2 receives questions or generates them. In either case, it directs attention and searches memory to find the answers. System 1 operates differently. It continuously monitors what is going on outside and inside the mind and continuously generates assessments of various aspects of the situation without specific intention and with little or no effort. These basic assessments play an important role in intuitive judgment because they are easily substituted for more difficult questions. This is the essential idea of the heuristics and biases approach. Two other features of System 1 also support the substitution of one judgment for another. One is the ability to translate values across dimensions, which you do in answering a question that most people find easy. If Sam were as tall as he is intelligent, how tall would he be? Finally, there is the mental shotgun. An intention of System 2 to answer a specific question or evaluate a particular attribute of the situation automatically triggers other computations, including basic assessments. Basic assessments. System 1 has been shaped by evolution to provide a continuous assessment of the main problems that an organism must solve to survive. How are things going? Is there a threat or a major opportunity? Is everything normal? Should I approach or avoid? The questions are perhaps less urgent for a human in a city environment than for a gazelle on the savanna, but we have inherited the neural mechanisms that evolved to provide ongoing assessments of threat level, and they have not been turned off. Situations are constantly evaluated as good or bad, requiring escape or permitting approach. Good mood and cognitive ease are the human equivalents of assessments of safety and familiarity. For a specific example of basic assessment, consider the ability to discriminate friend from foe at a glance. This contributes to one's chances of survival in a dangerous world, and such a specialized capability has indeed evolved. Alex Todorov, my colleague at Princeton, has explored the biological roots of the rapid judgments of how safe it is to interact with a stranger. He showed that we are endowed with an ability to evaluate, in a single glance at a stranger's face, two potentially crucial facts about that person: how dominant, and therefore potentially threatening, he is, and how trustworthy he is, whether his intentions are more likely to be friendly or hostile. The shape of the face provides the cues for assessing dominance. A strong, square chin is one such cue. Facial expression, smile or frown, provides the cues for assessing the stranger's intentions. The combination of a square chin with a turned-down mouth may spell trouble. The accuracy of face reading is far from perfect. Round chins are not a reliable indicator of meekness, and smiles can, to some extent, be faked. Still, even an imperfect ability to assess strangers confers a survival advantage. This ancient mechanism is put to a novel use in the modern world. It has some influence on how people vote. Todorov showed his students pictures of men's faces, sometimes for as little as 1/10 of a second, and asked them to rate the faces on various attributes, including likability and competence. Observers agreed quite well on those ratings. The faces that Todorov showed were not a random set. They were campaign portraits of politicians competing for elective office. Todorov then compared the results of the electoral races to the ratings of competence that Princeton students had made, based on brief exposure to photographs and without any political context. In about 70% of the races for senator, congressman, and governor, the election winner was the candidate whose face had earned a higher rating of competence. This striking result was quickly confirmed in national elections in Finland, in zoning board elections in England, and in various electoral contests in Australia, Germany, and Mexico. Surprisingly, at least to me, ratings of competence were far more predictive of voting outcomes in Todorov's study than ratings of likability. Todorov has found that people judge competence by combining the two dimensions of strength and trustworthiness. The faces that exude competence combine a strong chin with a slight confident-appearing smile. There is no evidence that these facial features actually predict how well politicians will perform in office. But studies of the brain's response to winning and losing candidates show that we are biologically predisposed to reject candidates who lack the attributes we value. In this research, losers evoked stronger indications of negative emotional response. This is an example of what I will call a judgment heuristic in the following chapters. Voters are attempting to form an impression of how good a candidate will be in office, and they fall back on a simpler assessment that is made quickly and automatically and is available when System 2 must make its decision. Political scientists followed up on Todorov's initial research by identifying a category of voters for whom the automatic preferences of System 1 are particularly likely to play a large role. They found what they were looking for among politically uninformed voters who watch a great deal of television. As expected, the effect of facial competence on voting is about 3 times larger for information-poor and TV-prone voters than for others who are better informed and watch less television. Evidently, The relative importance of System 1 in determining voting choices is not the same for all people. We will encounter other examples of such individual differences. System 1 understands language, of course, and understanding depends on the basic assessments that are routinely carried out as part of the perception of events and the comprehension of messages. These assessments include computations of similarity and representativeness, attributions of causality, and evaluations of the availability of associations and exemplars. They are performed even in the absence of a specific task set, although the results are used to meet task demands as they arise. The list of basic assessments is long, but not every possible attribute is assessed. For an example, look briefly at Figure 7 on the PDF. A glance provides an immediate impression of many features of the display. You know that the two towers are equally tall and that they are more similar to each other than the tower on the left is to the array of blocks in the middle. However, you do not immediately know that the number of blocks in the left-hand tower is the same as the number of blocks arrayed on the floor, and you have no impression of the height of the tower that you could build from them. To confirm that the numbers are the same, you would need to count the two sets of blocks and compare the results, an activity that only System 2 can carry out. Sets and prototypes. For another example, consider the question, what is the average length of the lines in Figure 8 on the PDF? This question is easy, and System 1 answers it without prompting. Experiments have shown that a fraction of a second is sufficient for people to register the average length of an array of lines with considerable precision. Furthermore, the accuracy of these judgments is not impaired when the observer is cognitively busy with a memory task. They do not necessarily know how to describe the average in inches or centimeters, but they will be very accurate in adjusting the length of another line to match the average. System 2 is not needed to form an impression of the norm of length for an array. System 1 does it, automatically and effortlessly, just as it registers the color of the lines and the fact that they are all vertical. We also can form an immediate impression of the number of objects in an array, precisely if there are four or fewer objects, crudely if there are more. Now to another question. What is the total length of the lines in Figure 8? This is a different experience, because System 1 has no suggestions to offer. The only way you can answer this question is by activating System 2, which will laboriously estimate the average, estimate or count the lines, and multiply average length by the number of lines. The failure of System 1 to compute the total length of a set of lines at a glance may look obvious to you. You never thought you could do it. It is, in fact, an instance of an important limitation of that system. Because System 1 represents categories by a prototype or a set of typical exemplars, it deals well with averages but poorly with sums. The size of the category, the number of instances it contains, tends to be ignored in judgments of what I will call sum-like variables. Participants in one of the numerous experiments that were prompted by the litigation following the disastrous Exxon Valdez oil spill were asked their willingness to pay for nets to cover oil ponds in which migratory birds often drown. Different groups of participants stated their willingness to pay to save 2,000, 20,000, or 200,000 birds. If saving birds is an economic good, it should be a sum-like variable. Saving 200,000 birds should be worth much more than saving 2,000 birds. In fact, the average contributions of the three groups were $80, $78, and $88, respectively. The number of birds made very little difference. What the participants reacted to in all three groups was a prototype. The awful image of a helpless bird drowning, its feathers soaked in thick oil. The almost complete neglect of quantity in such emotional contexts has been confirmed many times. Intensity matching. Questions about your happiness, the president's popularity, the proper punishment of financial evildoers, and the future prospects of a politician share an important characteristic. They all refer to an underlying dimension of intensity or amount, which permits the use of the word more. More happy, more popular, more severe, or more powerful for a politician. For example, a candidate's political future can range from the low of, she will be defeated in the primary, to a high of, she will someday be president of the United States. Here we encounter a new aptitude of System 1. An underlying scale of intensity allows matching across diverse dimensions. If crimes were colors, murder would be a deeper shade of red than theft. If crimes were expressed as music, mass murder would be played fortissimo, while accumulating unpaid parking tickets would be a faint pianissimo. And of course, you have similar feelings about the intensity of punishments. In classic experiments, people adjusted the loudness of a sound to the severity of crimes. Other people adjusted loudness to the severity of legal punishments. If you heard two notes, one for the crime and one for the punishment, you would feel a sense of injustice if one tone was much louder than the other. Consider an example that we will encounter again later. Julie read fluently when she was 4 years old. Now, match Julie's reading prowess as a child to the following intensity scales. How tall is a man who is as tall as Julie was precocious? What do you think of 6 feet? Obviously too little. What about 7 feet? Probably too much. You are looking for a height that is as remarkable as the achievement of reading at age 4. Fairly remarkable, but not extraordinary. Reading at 15 months would be extraordinary, perhaps like a man who is 7 feet 8 inches. What level of income in your profession matches Julie's reading achievement? Which crime is as severe as Julie was precocious? Which graduating GPA in an Ivy League college matches Julie's reading? Not very hard, was it? Furthermore, you can be assured that your matches will be quite close to those of other people in your cultural milieu. We will see that when people are asked to predict Julie's GPA from the information about the age at which she learned to read, they answer by translating from one scale to another and pick the matching GPA. And we will also see why this mode of prediction by matching is statistically wrong, although it is perfectly natural to System 1, and for most people, except statisticians, it is also acceptable to System 2. The Mental Shotgun. System 1 carries out many computations at any one time. Some of these are routine assessments that go on continuously. Whenever your eyes are open, your brain computes a three-dimensional representation of what is in your field of vision, complete with the shape of objects, their position in space, and their identity. No intention is needed to trigger this operation or the continuous monitoring for violated expectations. In contrast to these routine assessments, other computations are undertaken only when needed. You do not maintain a continuous evaluation of how happy or wealthy you are. And even if you are a political addict, you do not continuously assess the president's prospects. The occasional judgments are voluntary. They occur only when you intend them to do so. You do not automatically count the number of syllables in every word you read, but you can do it if you so choose. However, the control over intended computations is far from precise. We often compute much more than we want or need. I call this excess computation the mental shotgun. It is impossible to aim at a single point with a shotgun because it shoots pellets that scatter, and it seems almost equally difficult for System 1 not to do more than System 2 charges it to do. Two experiments that I read long ago suggested this image. Participants in one experiment listened to pairs of words with the instruction to press a key as quickly as possible whenever they detected that the words rhymed. The words rhyme in both these pairs. Vote, note. Vote, goat. The difference is obvious to you because you see the two pairs. Vote and goat rhyme, but they are spelled differently. The participants only heard the words, but they were also influenced by the spelling. They were distinctly slower to recognize the words as rhyming if their spelling was discrepant. Although the instructions required only a comparison of sounds, the participants also compared their spelling, and the mismatch on the irrelevant dimension slowed them down. An intention to answer one question evoked another, which was not only superfluous, but actually detrimental to the main task. In another study, people listened to a series of sentences with the instruction to press one key as quickly as possible to indicate if the sentence was literally true, and another key if the sentence was not literally true. What are the correct responses for the following sentences? Some roads are snakes. Some jobs are snakes. Some jobs are jails. All three sentences are literally false. However, you probably noticed that the second sentence is more obviously false than the other two. The reaction times collected in the experiment confirmed a substantial difference. The reason for the difference is that the two difficult sentences can be metaphorically true. Here again, the intention to perform one computation evoked another. And here again, the correct answer prevailed in the conflict, but the conflict with the irrelevant answer disrupted performance. In the next chapter, we will see that the combination of a mental shotgun with intensity matching explains why we have intuitive judgments about many things that we know little about. Speaking of judgment. Evaluating people as attractive or not is a basic assessment. You do that automatically whether or not you want to, and it influences you. There are circuits in the brain that evaluate dominance from the shape of the face. He looks the part for a leadership role. The punishment won't feel just unless its intensity matches the crime, just like you can match the loudness of a sound to the brightness of a light. This was a clear instance of a mental shotgun. He was asked whether he thought the company was financially sound, but he couldn't forget that he likes their product. Chapter 9. Answering an Easier Question. A remarkable aspect of your mental life is that you are rarely stumped. True, you occasionally face a question such as, 17 times 24 equals, to which no answer comes immediately to mind. But these dumbfounded moments are rare. The normal state of your mind is that you have intuitive feelings and opinions about almost everything that comes your way. You like or dislike people long before you know much about them. You trust or distrust strangers without knowing why. You feel that an enterprise is bound to succeed without analyzing it. Whether you state them or not, you often have answers to questions that you do not completely understand, relying on evidence that you can neither explain nor defend. Substituting questions. I propose a simple account of how we generate intuitive opinions on complex matters. If a satisfactory answer to a hard question is not found quickly, System 1 will find a related question that is easier and will answer it. I call the operation of answering one question in place of another substitution. I also adopt the following terms. The target question is the assessment you intend to produce. The heuristic question is the simpler question that you answer instead. The technical definition of heuristic is a simple procedure that helps find adequate, though often imperfect, answers to difficult questions. The word comes from the same root as eureka. The idea of substitution came up early in my work with Amos, and it was the core of what became the heuristics and biases approach. We asked ourselves how people manage to make judgments of probability without knowing precisely what probability is. We concluded that people must somehow simplify that impossible task, and we set out to find how they do it. Our answer was that when called upon to judge probability, people actually judge something else and believe they have judged probability. System 1 often makes this move when faced with difficult target questions if the answer to a related and easier heuristic question comes readily to mind. Substituting one question for another can be a good strategy for solving difficult problems. And George Polya included substitution in his classic, How to Solve It. If you can't solve a problem, then there is an easier problem you can solve. Find it. Polya's heuristics are strategic procedures that are deliberately implemented by System 2. But the heuristics that I discuss in this chapter are not chosen. They are a consequence of the mental shotgun. The imprecise control we have over targeting our responses to questions. Consider the target questions you are about to hear. These are difficult questions, and before you can produce a reasoned answer to any of them, you must deal with other difficult issues. What is the meaning of happiness? What are the likely political developments in the next 6 months? What are the standard sentences for other financial crimes? How strong is the competition that the candidate faces? What other environmental or other causes should be considered? Dealing with these questions seriously is completely impractical. But you are not limited to perfectly reasoned answers to questions. There is a heuristic alternative to careful reasoning, which sometimes works fairly well and sometimes leads to serious errors. Target question. How much would you contribute to save an endangered species? Heuristic question. How much emotion do I feel when I think of dying dolphins? Target question. How happy are you with your life these days? Heuristic question. What is my mood right now? Target question. How popular will the president be 6 months from now? Heuristic question. How popular is the president right now? Target question. How should financial advisors who prey on the elderly be punished? Heuristic question. How much anger do I feel when I think of financial predators? Target question. This woman is running for the primary. How far will she go in politics? Heuristic question. Does this woman look like a political winner? The mental shotgun makes it easy to generate quick answers to difficult questions without imposing much hard work on your lazy system, too. The heuristic counterpart of each of the target questions is very likely to be evoked and very easily answered. Your feelings about dolphins and financial crooks, your current mood, your impressions of the political skill of the primary candidate, or the current standing of the president will readily come to mind. The heuristic questions provide an off-the-shelf answer to each of the difficult target questions. Something is still missing from this story. The answers need to be fitted to the original questions. For example, my feelings about dying dolphins must be expressed in dollars. Another capability of System 1, intensity matching, is available to solve that problem. Recall that both feelings and contribution dollars are intensity scales. I can feel more or less strongly about dolphins, and there is a contribution that matches the intensity of my feelings. The dollar amount that will come to mind is the matching amount. Similar intensity matches are possible for all the questions. For example, the political skills of a candidate can range from pathetic to extraordinarily impressive, and the scale of political success can range from the low of, she will be defeated in the primary, to a high of, she will someday be president of the United States. The automatic processes of the mental shotgun and intensity matching often make available one or more answers to easy questions that could be mapped onto the target question. On some occasions, substitution will occur and a heuristic answer will be endorsed by System 2. Of course, System 2 has the opportunity to reject this intuitive answer or to modify it by incorporating other information. However, a lazy System 2 often follows the path of least effort and endorses a heuristic answer without much scrutiny of whether it is truly appropriate. You will not be stumped. You will not have to work very hard, and you may not even notice that you did not answer the question you were asked. Furthermore, you may not realize that the target question was difficult, because an intuitive answer to it came readily to mind. The 3D heuristic. Have a look at the picture of the three men in Figure 9 on the PDF, and answer the question that follows. Is the figure on the right larger than the figure on the left? The obvious answer comes quickly to mind. The figure on the right is larger. If you take a ruler to the two figures, however, you will discover that in fact the figures are exactly the same size. Your impression of their relative size is dominated by a powerful illusion, which neatly illustrates the process of substitution. The corridor in which the figures are seen is drawn in perspective and appears to go into the depth plane. Your perceptual system automatically interprets the picture as a three-dimensional scene, not as an image printed on a flat paper surface. In the 3D interpretation, the person on the right is both much farther away and much larger than the person on the left. For most of us, this impression of 3D size is overwhelming. Only visual artists and experienced photographers have developed the skill of seeing the drawing as an object on the page. For the rest of us, substitution occurs. The dominant impression of 3D size dictates the judgment of 2D size. The illusion is due to a 3D heuristic. What happens here is a true illusion, not a misunderstanding of the question. You knew that the question about the size of the figures in the picture. If you had been asked to estimate the size of the figures, we know from experiments that your answer would have been in inches, not feet. You were not confused about the question, but you were influenced by the answer to a question that you were not asked. How tall are the three people? The essential step in the heuristic, the substitution of three-dimensional for two-dimensional size, occurred automatically. The picture contains cues that suggest a 3D interpretation. These cues are irrelevant to the task at hand, the judgment of size of the figure, and you should have ignored them. But you could not. The bias associated with the heuristic is that objects that appear to be more distant also appear to be larger. As this example illustrates, a judgment that is based on substitution will inevitably be biased in predictable ways. In this case, it happens so deep in the perceptual system that you simply cannot help it. The mood heuristic for happiness. A survey of German students is one of the best examples of substitution. The survey that the young participants completed included the following two questions. How happy are you these days? How many dates did you have last month? The experimenters were interested in the correlation between the two answers. Would the students who reported many dates say that they were happier than those with fewer dates? Surprisingly, no. The correlation between the answers was about zero. Evidently, dating was not what came first to the students' minds when they were asked to assess their happiness. Another group of students saw the same two questions, but in reverse order. How many dates did you have last month? How happy are you these days? The results this time were completely different. In this sequence, the correlation between the number of dates and reported happiness was about as high as correlations between psychological measures can get. What happened? The explanation is straightforward, and it is a good example of substitution. Dating was apparently not the center of these students' life. In the first survey, happiness and dating were uncorrelated. But when they were asked to think about their romantic life, they certainly had an emotional reaction. The students who had many dates were reminded of a happy aspect of their life, while those who had none were reminded of loneliness and rejection. The emotion aroused by the dating question was still on everyone's mind when the query about general happiness came up. The psychology of what happened is precisely analogous to the psychology of the size illusion in Figure 9. Happiness these days is not a natural or an easy assessment. A good answer requires a fair amount of thinking. However, the students who had just been asked about their dating did not need to think hard because they already had in their mind an answer to a related question: how happy they were with their love life. They substituted the question to which they had a ready-made answer for the question they were asked. Here again, as we did for the illusion, we can ask, are the students confused? Do they really think that the two questions, the one they were asked and the one they answer, are synonymous? Of course not. The students do not temporarily lose their ability to distinguish romantic life from life as a whole. If asked about the two concepts, they would say they are different. But they were not asked whether the concepts are different. They were asked how happy they were, and System 1 has a ready answer. Dating is not unique. The same pattern is found if a question about the students' relations with their parents or about their finances immediately precedes the question about general happiness. In both cases, satisfaction in the particular domain dominates happiness reports. Any emotionally significant question that alters a person's mood will have the same effect. What you see is all there is. The present state of mind looms very large when people evaluate their happiness. The affect heuristic. The dominance of conclusions over arguments is most pronounced where emotions are involved. The psychologist Paul Slovic has proposed an affect heuristic in which people let their likes and dislikes determine their beliefs about the world. Your political preference determines the arguments that you find compelling. If you like the current health policy, you believe its benefits are substantial and its costs more manageable than the costs of alternatives. If you are a hawk in your attitude to other nations, you probably think they are relatively weak and likely to submit to your country's will. If you are a dove, you probably think they are strong and will not be easily coerced. Your emotional attitude to such things as irradiated food, red meat, nuclear power, tattoos, or motorcycles drives your beliefs about their benefits and their risks. If you dislike any of these things, you probably believe that its risks are high and its benefits negligible. The primacy of conclusions does not mean that your mind is completely closed and that your opinions are wholly immune to information and sensible reasoning. Your beliefs and even your emotional attitude may change, at least a little, when you learn that the risk of an activity you disliked is smaller than you thought. However, the information about lower risks will also change your view of the benefits, for the better, even if nothing was said about benefits in the information you received. We see here a new side of the personality of System 2. Until now, I have mostly described it as a more or less acquiescent monitor, which allows considerable leeway to System 1. I have also presented System 2 as active in deliberate memory search, complex computations, comparisons, planning, and choice. In the bat and ball problem, and in many other examples of the interplay between the two systems, it appeared that System 2 is ultimately in charge, with the ability to resist the suggestions of System 1, slow things down, and impose logical analysis. Self-criticism is one of the functions of System 2. In the context of attitudes, however, System 2 is more of an apologist for the emotions of System 1 than a critic of those emotions, an endorser rather than an enforcer. Its search for information and arguments is mostly constrained to information that is consistent with existing beliefs, not with an intention to examine them. An active, coherence-seeking System 1 suggests solutions to an undemanding System 2. Speaking of substitution and heuristics, do we still remember the question we are trying to answer, or have we substituted an easier one? The question we face is whether this candidate can succeed. The question we seem to answer is whether she interviews well. Let's not substitute. He likes the project, so he thinks its costs are low and its benefits are high. Nice example of the affect heuristic. We are using last year's performance as a heuristic to predict the value of the firm several years from now. Is this heuristic good enough? What other information do we need? Following is a list of features and activities that have been attributed to System 1. Each of the active sentences replaces a statement, technically more accurate but harder to understand, to the effect that a mental event occurs automatically and fast. My hope is that the list of traits will help you develop an intuitive sense of the personality of the fictitious System 1. As it happens with other characters you know, you will have hunches about what System 1 would do under different circumstances, and most of your hunches will be correct. Characteristics of System 1. Generates impressions, feelings, and inclinations. When endorsed by System 2, these become beliefs, attitudes, and intentions. Operates automatically and quickly, with little or no effort, and no sense of voluntary control. Can be programmed by System 2 to mobilize attention when a particular pattern is detected. Search. Executes skilled responses and generates skilled intuitions after adequate training. Creates a coherent pattern of activated ideas in associative memory. Links a sense of cognitive ease to illusions of truth, pleasant feelings, and reduced vigilance. distinguishes the surprising from the normal. Infers and invents causes and intentions. Neglects ambiguity and suppresses doubt. Is biased to believe and confirm. Exaggerates emotional consistency, halo effect. Focuses on existing evidence and ignores absent evidence. What you see is all there is.